the old tubes.
There, he gave you the thumbs.
The Senate House Conference Committee will come to order on Senate File 0958, the Omnibus Budget Bill. For the record, today's date is May 12th, 2011. Reviewing the budget bill, we wanted to give a little bit more time for testimony today. We're going to be hearing from representatives from the Guardian Ad Litem Board, the Civil Legal Services and MinnPost Board, and we'll be starting out with the State Guardian Ad Litem Board. Welcome to the committee. I believe we have roughly 10 minutes for each of these groups, and then we may have some time for some brief questions by members, and then we'll be closing the meeting after that and moving on to other things. Welcome to the committee. Would
you
identify yourself for the
Senator Limmer. My name is Leslie Metzen. I am currently the chair of the State Guardian Ad Litem Board, and I'm a former district court judge, having served in Dakota County for 23 years. I could certainly speak at length with all of you about the important work of the Guardian Ad Litem for district court judges, but I would prefer that you hear from both our program administrator, Suzanne Allegro, and one of our Guardian Ad Litems from Hennepin County who works in the family court program there, Jean Peterson. So I will turn it over to them.
All right. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Suzanne Allegro, and I'm the program administrator for the State Guardian Ad Litem Board. Thank you for the opportunity to address the conference committee on behalf of the Guardian Ad Litem Program Board and the Guardian Ad Litems around the state. As you know, the Guardian Ad Litem is appointed by the court in a particular case to best represent the interests of an abused and or neglected child. The individual guardians, as well as the program, have committed themselves to giving abused and neglected children a strong voice in our court system as they perform their respective roles. Over the years, we have made substantial progress towards increasing the number of children represented and generating better outcomes for children. In 2001, once the guardian ad litem system became state-funded, the court focused on increasing coverage of mandated cases, which under the county-funded system was approximately 55%. Within a few years, with the current level of our funding now, the program has been able to achieve close to 100% coverage of mandated cases in juvenile and family courts. This is obviously a goal we must maintain, as we are federally mandated to cover abuse and neglect filings in juvenile court, and by state law on abuse and neglect cases in family and juvenile court. Additionally, the court has discretion to appoint guardians ad litem in dissolution custody matters and does so with increasing frequency. Presently, on average, about 15,000 children are represented by our program. The $1 million or 8% cut as proposed by the Senate would result in about 1,200 children not having a guardian ad litem to represent their interest in court decisions that will determine their fate. There are several considerations to be aware of in discussing which children would no longer receive services. The Guardian Ad Litem Board has placed priority on mandated cases receiving representation, while also understanding the critical need for permissive appointments. As provided for in statute, the judges can order a permissive appointment in family court when the bench is in need of custody and or parenting time recommendations. In these types of appointments, there is typically no other resource available to the judge, and the parties are often in form of pauperous. The judge is faced with finding an affordable neutral to adjust the custody parenting time issues or determining whether allegations are sufficient for a mandatory appointment. In many instances, the judge can do neither and makes the permissive appointment, which the program finds has a difficult time ignoring. If we sustain a $1 million cut, it will result in a large number of at-risk children in bitterly contested custody proceedings in family court not having any representation, as the program will be focused on mandated cases. The lack of guardians in family court also may result in increased litigation, court delays, and prolonged conflict in families where custody and visitation dispute place children in harm's way. It also will create an unequal system of representation for the children's interests, which would only be provided for in those cases where the parents have the ability to pay for private parties to perform the necessary services. Children in contested cases deserve the same level of representation regardless of family income. Guardian ad litems are appointed statewide in approximately 9% of family court cases. However, as I indicated previously, the demand for services of a guardian ad litem in family court cases is increasing, especially in order for protection cases. Recognizing the need for our services in family court and that funding will continue to be an issue, the Guardian Ad Litem Board is working towards having the permissive appointments become more self-sustaining. The board has recently increased the fee amounts which we can charge parties, and those fee amounts had been in place since 2003, and the program has also begun centralizing collections in order to maximize revenue. We will, however, not be able to collect fees in all cases as the number of informal pauperous parties has risen with the recent economic downturn. We ask for your support as we continue to provide program representation to children in need of our services. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Who would be next?
I will. My name is Jean Peterson. I've been a guardian ad litem in Hennepin County Family Court for 10 years. Thank you for giving me a few moments to talk about the permissive appointment versus the mandatory appointment debate from the perspective of someone who gets and works with both kinds of cases. Permissive cases can be atypical or typical, but they sometimes turn out to be the cases where children are most at risk. For example, cases that involve chronic long-term not include allegations of abuse or neglect can be harmful for children. The long-term conflict those children are exposed to is in and of itself detrimental to children, and they need an advocate to speak for them in those cases. Permissive cases, upon initial review by the court, may not present issues that rise to the level of a mandatory. But judges may hear some concerns about the children that warrant further investigation or require gathering more information. Judges should have the discretion to appoint a guardian if they have legitimate questions or concerns about a child's well-being, but do not have blatant or concrete allegations of abuse or neglect. At least in Hennepin County, our bench does not appoint a guardian for permissive cases without thoughtful consideration and deliberation. Our immediate supervisor also screens all permissive appointments for appropriateness. I work with 10 other guardians in family court. In recent discussions with them, we are in agreement that our permissive cases often ultimately look just like our mandatory cases. There's little distinction. In discussing the situations in our permissive cases, we find that the risk for children is often the same or even worse as in our mandatory cases.
Ms. Peterson, could I interrupt? Members, if you have any cell phones near the microphones, you may want to move them away. I had to move mine away the first time, but usually that cures the interference that we have, but as we just continue.
I wanted to leave you with an example of a permissive appointment with a fact scenario that's similar to one of our cases. A guardian was appointed to a post-dissolution case involving two teenage boys. The judge ordered the guardian to determine whether either parent was being abusive to the children and what type of parenting time would be best for the children. Both children resided with their father. One child was refusing to see his mother at all, and the other child was expressing a strong desire to live with his mother on a full-time basis. And that child had maintained regular parenting time with his mother. The guardian met with the parents, interviewed the children, reviewed collateral information, and reviewed information provided by the parties. The guardian became very concerned about the level of conflict within the family. There were also concerns about triangulation in the family, parental alienation, and each parent was alleging that both of the children were being emotionally abused by the other parent. The guardian also had concerns about chemical dependency issues for both parents. The guardian recommended chemical dependency evaluations for the parties and also recommended that the parents and children meet with a child psychologist to assess the children and the situation and provide some guidance about how to reduce the conflict in this family and ensure that these children were being looked after. I'd like to leave you with this question. If you had been the judge on this case, how would you make a determination about whether or not either parent was being abusive or about parenting time for these teenage boys without all of the information provided to the court by the guardian ad litem? Thank you.
Thank you. Does that conclude your testimony? Thank you so much. Please stick around because we're going to have questions after all three. Next will be from Civil Legal Services, Kathy Akadal. I hope I pronounced that correctly.
You did, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kathy Akadal, and I'm Executive Director of Mid-Minnesota Legal Assistance. And with me is Gary Hurd, who is the Chief Operating Officer of Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services. We're here together today to represent the various programs that provide civil legal services in Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. We recognize the serious challenges that you face, and we appreciate them. We have faced very serious challenges ourselves in the past 3 years. The economic downturn has resulted in many more people living in poverty in Minnesota. There is an increased, as a result, demand for our services. At the same time, we have had continually decreasing resources. So just as the demand has increased, we cannot help as many people. Coming into this legislative session, Civil Legal Services had already faced an 11% reduction in our general fund funding from the state since 2008. Other parts of the justice system have not experienced the same level of cuts. In addition, we've had a dramatic and unanticipated decrease in the funds available from interest on lawyers' trust account, or IOLTA funds. IOLTA funds available to civil legal services have declined 80% since 2008, again due to the recession. Despite these financial challenges, civil legal services did not request an increase in our funding. We didn't ask for anything to make us whole. We advanced a budget request that simply helped us at held us at level funding and didn't make it worse, and that's what we ask of you today. Unfortunately, the current proposals make the situation considerably worse for us. The House proposal is effectively a 25% reduction in state funds for legal services in the base. If adopted, this will mean that several thousand additional low-income Minnesotans will not have access to our services, to remain housed, to remain safe, to seek medical care, and to seek food. The Senate proposals reflect a 6.5% reduction of our funding. This cut is much less. However, it remains disproportionate to other parts of the justice system. The Chief Justice recommended to the governor that civil legal services have level funding as the appropriate strategy to make sure there was adequate funding for the entire justice system. We ask that you accept that recommendation. The restrictions in the House rider are of particular concern for us. They will dramatically negatively affect the services we are able to provide. For example, they will mean that we can't use state funds to help poor, disabled, and elderly Minnesotans get disability and health care benefits. They will mean that we cannot prevent homelessness for poor Minnesotans who happen to live in public housing. They will mean that we cannot help unemployed low-income Minnesotans obtain unemployment compensation. The restrictions will also mean that we cannot use state funds to leverage literally millions of dollars of other funds that we leverage with those unrestricted funds that we've had for 30 years. For example, we obtain for our clients $5 million a year in federal disability benefits for seniors and people with disabilities. Over 10 years, it's a cumulative impact of $275 million. In addition, we leverage the state unrestricted funds to obtain several hundred thousand dollars a year in federal grant money. That would be very difficult without the unrestricted state funds, if not impossible. And in addition, we use the state funds to support volunteer attorney resources in the state, and we leverage about $40 million a year value of volunteer attorney resources. These restrictions would mean that we couldn't use those funds to address any area with volunteer attorneys that were restricted by the proposed legislation. Civil legal services is essential for all Minnesotans to have access to the justice system. It's also a good investment. In addition to leveraging the funds, as I've noted, we increase the judicial system's efficiency by keeping unmeritorious claims out of the system and helping meritorious plaintiffs who would otherwise be in the system pro se proceed much more efficiently, settling thousands of cases before trial. By doing this, it's estimated that we save the judicial system $5 million a year. The proposed disproportionate cuts to civil legal services will undermine not only the justice system, but actual justice in Minnesota. The best option for you is that was advanced by the Chief Justice to the Governor, which was level funding for civil legal services. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hockendahl. Any other testimony?
No.
Thank you. We'll now hear from Neil Melton, Executive Director of Minnesota Post Board. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Neil Melton. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Post Board. And the board wants me to extend my thanks to the Senate for their version of no cuts to the Post Board this year. We are concerned about the House version that has a 8% reduction to the reimbursement. And if time permits, I'll talk about the impact of the governor's recommendations as well. The bottom line is, the 8% reduction in the training reimbursement would reduce the per officer share, based on last year's figures, from $358 to $334. That's per officer across the state. However, that again is offset to the positive a little bit by the proposal to extend the emergency vehicle operations pursuit driving from its current every 4 years to every 5 years. Using average figures across the state, that would save about $15. So the final count, at least from the House version, would be a reduction of $9 per officer. The Post Board is very concerned, of course, about the governor's recommendation that takes $57,000 out of our operating budget. That would mean a staff layoff. And we've had a 25% layoff since 2003. We've lost 4 employees out of 15. So later on, when you ask questions or have questions, I would be more than glad to share with you the impact of the training reimbursement cuts to individual agencies across the state.
Thank you. We'll open it up for questions. Members, have any questions? Well, I have a couple of questions. if I could ask civil legal to come up.
Smith will, yeah.
And Ms. Hockendahl, the question I had, you had made mention that you, could you go over the federal disability issue again?
Yes.
You had made comment on that. And
yes.
Could you repeat that figure again?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity. Yes, we help clients to bring in $5 million a year in federal disability benefits that go to seniors and people with disabilities. That means that those people do not then receive state disability and health care benefits, so that it is federal money coming in that relieves the Minnesota taxpayers.
And Ms. Hockendahl, you also made mention of a $275 million figure. And what was that representing?
The $5 million a year is ongoing and cumulative. It's every single year. So we've calculated that over the course of 10 years, we believe it would be $275 million total.
Okay. Your organization receives federal grants?
Well, some of the legal services organizations receive money from the Federal Legal Services Corporation. Not all of them. In fact, mine does not. We're the second largest civil legal services organization in the state, and we do not receive any Legal Services Corporation money. In fact, Legal Services Corporation funds constitute about only 10% of the entire funding in the civil legal services system. We do receive other grants, and different organizations in the system receive different grants. Those are grants that are always to do specific tasks and have specific deliverables associated with them. So, for example, both Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services and Mid-Minnesota have a contract with HUD to provide assistance to people in foreclosure. But it's very specific to that area and has very specific case numbers associated with it. But we do leverage the state money. That's a good example of where we leverage the state money. We have to provide match in order to even get that money from HUD.
Did I hear you correctly that your portion of the service for civil legal does not collect federal grants, but statewide, does a statewide system collect federal grants?
The total amount of Federal Legal Services Corporation money that comes into the state is about 10% of the total funding, and there are five programs, I believe, five of the 30 programs that receive it.
The question I have is, of that 10%, do you allocate from federal grant money the application of that federal grant money to issues that would involve a federal matter like federal disability benefits?
Mr. Chair, I think I would ask Gary Hurd to address that because my organization doesn't receive any Federal Legal Services
All right.
Corporation
funds. Mr. Hurd, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gary Hurd. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services. Mr. Chairman, the Legal Services Corporation is probably the most flexible of the federal funding that's received in the state. It does not have specific targeted types of cases that it would be used on. So it could be used for a variety of federal and state purposes. Unfortunately, only five programs in the state have that federal funding. And so those programs would be able to use that flexibility, but the 25 other programs don't have that kind of funding.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Ms. Huggendahl, with about one, first of all, why aren't you receiving any federal funds?
Ms. Huggendahl.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, there was a decision made quite a number of years ago, I believe about 15 years ago, to have one program in the state that didn't receive the Federal Legal Services Corporation funds, and it was decided that we would be the program that did that. We have several statewide programs, for example, the Minnesota Disability Law Center. It made for some cleaner delivery of legal services. Our regional programs all work very closely together. The amount of federal legal services funding coming in, as I say, is only 10% of the whole system and is actually declining. So even if we received those funds, it doesn't mean that that would be a replacement at all for the loss of the ability to use state funds to leverage that $5 million a year. That would cause a shift that I think would be extremely difficult for the programs to all achieve programmatically as they try to meet other needs in family law and housing, et cetera.
Mr. Chairman, two more questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Smith.
Ms. Huggendahl, with about a third of your funding coming from the state, and therefore two-thirds not coming from the state, in what way does limiting the use of state funds to state civil matters hinder your ability to serve clients with federal issues when you do have either federal or other non-state funds available?
Ms. Huckadel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, most of the funds that come in other than the state funds are tied to specific deliverables. Like the mortgage foreclosure money I mentioned, there are a number of other grants we get, It used to be that many foundations in the United Way, for example, provided funding that was very flexible in the use of it. That is no longer the case. Any of our United Way and foundation money across the state is very tied to specific areas and deliverables. There's no flexibility. That's the same with all the government contracts we have, that they are tied to specific areas. So to have the flexibility to meet changing client needs in areas like especially government benefits, where it is extraordinarily difficult to get any government contracts or to get any foundation money.
Chairman.
Representative Smith.
Ms. Huggendahl, if federal funding is either non-existent or insufficient to serve clients with federal issues, then isn't that an issue for you to take to Congress rather than imposing that mandate on the state?
Ms. Huggendahl.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, for Federal Legal Services Corporation, we do, the coalition does work frequently with Congress to try to maintain that funding and to increase it. But in the case of bringing in the federal disability benefits to the state of Minnesota, I think there is a strong state interest because that's $5 million that benefits the Minnesota taxpayers. And I think Congress might view that as a state issue, even more than a federal issue.
Mr. Chairman, and
Representative Smith.
Members of the state legislature may consider an issue that you should take up with Congress rather than with the state on federal issues. Thank you.
Ms. Huggendahl.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I understand your position.
Right. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Huggendahl, you had indicated that your program receives about $5 million a year in disability benefits on behalf of your clients from various federal programs. Of the $5 million that you are able to recover on behalf of your clients, what portion, if any, is returned to your program in the way of fees that you have recovered?
Ms. Huggendahl.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, in the case of those benefits, we do not recover, really for most of our clients, we recover no money at all. I don't have an exact figure as to whether in those particular disability benefit programs we recover. If we do, it's extremely minimal. We really recover very little money from any source relating to our clients.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
I believe you had mentioned that you also take on clients for the purposes of obtaining unemployment benefits. Do you or does your program charge those folks anything for the work that you do on their behalf of obtaining unemployment benefits?
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, no, we do not request a fee from our clients. In order to be eligible for our services, a person has to have an income that's 125% of the federal poverty guidelines. For a family of four, that's $28,000 a year. Our clients really cannot afford an attorney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Any other questions of the previous panels that we had here today?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and
You're
committee.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Cornish, you're going to be having the gavel tomorrow. And could you announce the time of the committee that you wish to have?
I'm hoping it's 7 o'clock. Right. 7 a.m. tomorrow. So.
I thought you meant p.m.
No. So everybody, are the doors open in the Capitol at that time?
Well, we can get in.
We'll get them open.
Right. And it would be in this room.
This room. Look forward to seeing you all here.
Yeah. I think our meeting is over for the day. There's no other further business before the committee. Meeting is adjourned.
Yes. I like your style.
9:00 in the morning.
Much better than 8:00 at night.
Good job.